Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People here on a Labor Day weekend. We're bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to do a couple segments on the environment. We're going to talk invasive plants with an expert from UConn whose department is hosting the ever popular biennial Invasive Plants Symposium. We're going to find out why you should learn a bit more about the non-native plants that are killing our yards, parks, and woodlands, and we're going to invite you to attend this important upcoming event. Then, as we roll through the last long weekend of summer that maybe includes your last trip down to the shoreline, we're going to flash back to June and a chat that we had during National Ocean Month with a research scientist from UConn and the Mystic Aquarium focusing on our connections to and concerns about Long Island Sound and how everyone in Connecticut can help be better stewards of our sound and the global ocean network. Then we're going to close with our sources at CERC, the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, and get the latest update on the second quarter's Inform CT, Connecticut Consumer Confidence Survey, that gauges state's residents' concerns about the economy and other critical issues impacting our families, workforce, and communities. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Thousands of kids and families are going to descend on Stamford's Mill River Park for a weekend of fitness and activities during the fourth annual Bankwell Stamford Spartan Kids event on the weekend of September 15th and 16th. This event features Spartan's signature kids obstacle races for boys and girls ages 4 to 13, and in a new partnership with Bankwell, the two companies will spread their shared messages of health and wellness to bring more kids than ever onto the race course to have fun while running, climbing, and crawling. In addition to conquering challenges on the course like the spear throw and the low crawl, the Bankwell Stamford Spartan Kids Race boasts a festival with activities that are fun for the whole family and include games, healthy food options, art installations, and more. The Spartan Kids Race is open for registration, and if you want more information on the Bankwell Stamford Kids Race, including costs and registration, just go to Spartan.com. Well, every 2 years, the folks up at UConn get together and they host a very important and informational invasives symposium. We are pleased to feature this event on our program a couple of times in the past. This year is the ninth biennial conference, and it's going to feature national, regional, and local experts as well as citizen volunteers sharing practical solutions for invasive plant management and the actions needed to promote native species and improve wildlife habitat. We're so pleased to have on the program Donna Ellis. She's the senior extension educator and the IPM program coordinator. She's also co-chair of the Connecticut Invasive Plant Working Group. So even if you're not going to be able to go to the conference, which we'll be hearing a lot about over the next 10 or 12 minutes, we're going to wrap up the program with some practical advice for anyone out there who may have or are battling invasives on their own property, as I am. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But for now, let's build some excitement about this activity that's coming up, Donna, because essentially it almost, if not completely, sells out every year before the event even opens. So anybody who's interested really needs to kind of put Thursday, October 4th onto their calendar as it's coming more quickly than we probably think, and make sure they get their tickets because they do sell out.
That's correct. We can't take any walk-ins anymore. We used to have a lot of space. Each time we'd present the event, we would outgrow the venue. We'd have to keep moving to a larger and larger buildings. And now we're at the University of Connecticut Student Union, which has a lot of space for us, but we still max out at 500 attendees. So it's very exciting.
So tell us a little bit about the diverse audience that you draw. This is not just scientists, and it's not just property owners that are whacking and trying to rid their yards and properties of invasives.
Yes, we are excited to have all sorts of guests attend the conference. From municipal staff, we'll have individuals from Parks and Rec, Public Works, Inland Wetlands, Conservation Commissions. We have a number of professionals from the green industry that would include nursery, tree, landscape professionals. We'll have landscape architects, landscape designers. There will be members of a lot of the state agencies, federal employees, conservation organizations, students. We'll have high school students, college students, researchers, scientists, and the general public will attend, too. So it's a very nice mix and a lot of great networking that goes on during the day.
This is undoubtedly becoming so much more popular and moving into larger and larger venues and selling out every 2 years when you hold it. Because obviously Connecticut and the region has a problem that maybe is not getting better as quickly as we might hope, or maybe even in fact getting worse. Where does Connecticut stand right now in terms of invasive plants and the widespread environmental damage that they can do?
Connecticut certainly has its share of invasives. We spend a lot of our efforts in the Connecticut Invasive Plant Working Group, and also with some of the activities I do at the University of Connecticut, conducting educational outreach. It's important for everyone to learn about these non-native invasive plants, why they're an issue. They are out competing and taking over important habitats where native plants are growing. So the first step is really to learn about them, learn to identify them, determine what you might have in your backyard, in your community gardens, in your land trusts, town and state properties, and then take steps to decide what kind of management can be done to reduce those populations, and then encourage the return or the introduction of the native or at least non-native but non-invasive species.
Do you know, since you've been doing this work, whether invasive plant species have actually virtually eliminated one or more native species here in Connecticut?
I'm not sure how much funded research has gone on in certain ecosystems in our state. It appears, certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that the invasives are really overpopulating many of our woodlands and wetlands and meadows, to the extent that if one were to conduct inventories, it's likely that they may not see certain species. That doesn't mean that they're gone from the state, but we do have a state checklist of plants that are threatened, endangered, or a special concern, and so there's always that that concern that those species will be further reduced in population. But beyond that checklist, there are still many different native plants that we're really trying to keep thriving. And when you visit these sites over time, you do see that their populations are dwindling. So I would anticipate that's probably the case.
What are one or two of the most widespread invasive plants in Connecticut that have taken the greatest hold on our woodlands and communities?
The top two in my book are Japanese knotweed, which is a perennial herbaceous plant that can get very tall. It will grow along riverbanks. It will grow along roadsides. It will grow in a lot of different habitats, sunny, part sunny locations. It has underground creeping stems called rhizomes that make it very problematic to control. The other species in my top two is Oriental or Asiatic bittersweet. This is a woody vine that will not only grow and spread in the area, but can actually smother desirable species, trees, shrubs, because the woody nature of the vines can grow into the trunks and stems of plants that you might have in a landscape.
Yeah, but to give folks who may not be as familiar as you,
yes,
these are just two of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of invasive plants that are somewhere in Connecticut.
We have a list in this state of 97 non-native invasive plants that are either considered to be invasive or potentially invasive. Some of those are prohibited by statute from being bought, sold, transplanted, cultivated, moved, unless you're controlling them or using them for research or education. So those are the list of the most problematic species. There are many other non-native plants, but they have not been designated to be invasive in the state. So we basically have just about 100 plants.
Oh, so I guess to rephrase,
yes.
Hundreds of plants impacting thousands of locations.
Absolutely, yes.
And yards and parcels and
that's
and,
right.
And
there are
forests.
All sorts of habitats. Many plants will do well in full sun. Some will do well, you know, partially sunny or shady locations. But we have a lot of those, we sort of call them, you know, roadside, abandoned areas, disturbed habitat, where plants will just come in if there's an opportunity. And this is where invasive plants flourish.
Very good. Folks, if you're listening and this is something that is kind of impacting your property, your yard, your business, or some woodlands or open space in your community, maybe you want to consider attending this biennial CIPWG symposium, Invasive Plants in Uncertain Times, Achieving More with Less, is this year's theme. It's being presented by the Connecticut Invasive Plant Working Group, and we are talking with its co-chair right now, Donna Ellis. She's a senior extension educator and the IPM program coordinator at the University of Connecticut's Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture. As we said, this event is coming up at UConn on Thursday, October 4th, 8 to 4:30, and it is going to be a sellout. So we urge you to get your tickets now. We'll get website information for you in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, as we move into the second half of our conversation, let's find out a little bit about some of the breakout sessions that you're looking forward to hosting at this symposium, Donna.
We have six afternoon sessions. Two of the sessions are going to focus on invasive plant management. Every event that we hold over the years, there's always a demand for the attendees to learn about the best ways to manage invasives. There are updates, and for some that are just kind of new to the invasive plant information, they really would like to learn what are the basics. So we're going to have an introductory session and then an advanced session, and there will be two different times so people can attend both of those sessions. We'll also have a session on native alternatives, looking at pollinator habitat and other goals, where one can learn more about the plants that can be put into these habitats as invasives are controlled. We'll have some updates on some new technologies for invasives. Talks will feature a UConn grad student who's looking at using drones to map invasives in woodland areas. So that'd be kind of interesting to find out the latest. And then we're going to have a session on the nursery industry and alternatives. These are options that people can learn about, whether they're native or just non-native and non-invasive plants that they can put into the habitats or even their backyards as they control invasives.
Very good. And, of course, let's not leave out Judy Preston, your
yes.
keynote speaker. What is she going to be discussing?
We're excited to have Judy as our keynote. She'll be speaking in the morning, and her topic is Raising the Bar on Sustainability, Transcending the Gardener. Judy will talk about the growing importance of backyard, you know, gardeners and anyone who's doing landscape design to incorporate and think about ecological needs for these habitats, with invasives being removed and thinking about natives and the very important role of natives, and how we can provide sustainable, ongoing habitats that will support wildlife, you know, from the smallest insects up to mammals.
Yeah, speaking of which, one of the breakout sessions is on native alternatives and pollinators, and I guess I would be remiss given the kind of downward trending that we're seeing in the population of pollinators, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country and even around the world. Are there particular invasives in Connecticut that are actually harmful or do not necessarily sustain or promote our population of pollinators?
There have been studies. One individual that some of their listeners may be familiar with is Doug Tallamy, a professor from the University of Delaware, who published two editions of Bringing Nature Home. And the studies that Doug has conducted with his students have shown that native plants support far more beneficial species, including pollinators, you know, moths and butterflies and beetles, than invasive plants. And the difference is striking. There may be a plant such as, if you think about oaks can support hundreds and hundreds of different pollinators when they're planted in a habitat. And if you have an invasive plant, Phragmites, for example, supports five different pollinators. So it's night and day, the ability to provide what pollinators need in habitats with native plants versus especially the non-native invasive species.
Okay, good. Well, before we close, for folks who may not be able to attend the symposium, could you offer a couple of tips to property owners and homeowners who may be either battling invasives or who may be blessed to have few or none on their property and want to keep it that way?
Sure. We have a lot of resources on the Connecticut Invasive Plant Working Group website. You can just Google that, and the website will come right up. It's www.cipwg.ucon.edu. And if you look at the publications, both the SIPWG and the external publications, we have some nice guides that will offer photos and pictures. I think the best way is to take things slowly, to maybe do an inventory in your yard to see which plants are taking over and maybe a little too aggressive and try to get identification on those. And then once you find, if you do have invasive plants, what you can do. Many times if it's a small population, plants can be dug or hand-pulled, and then just keep an eye on those spots over a couple of years to make sure that they don't return. And then see what's coming back in those areas when you've done the management.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, I imagine some of these 100 or so invasives that have been identified in Connecticut, really once they get started, as you mentioned, one species that had a kind of a very long underground root structure, some are virtually impossible to eliminate without, I guess, almost heavy machine dredging, right?
It really depends on the site and how long the populations have grown. We have property owners who will just diligently address the site year after year, and while the plants may have those underground stems or the rhizomes, with time you may have to do a little bit of deeper digging and trying to cut and really stress the plants. It may take a couple of years, but if you stick with it, you'll have success, from year one going forward, and hopefully you can slowly reduce that population. But it's not an overnight fix, and one does need to monitor those sites for several years.
Very good. Great advice, and a very appreciated invitation from our guest this morning, Donna Ellis. She's the Senior Extension Educator and IPM Program Coordinator, co-chair of the Connecticut Invasive Plant Working Group up at the University of Connecticut, and with their Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture, they are hosting their next invasive plant symposium, Invasive Plants in Uncertain Times, Achieving More with Less. It's coming up on Thursday, October 4th at the Student Union at UConn in stores from 8 to 4:30. Get your tickets now because these events have been more recently selling out, and you could learn more about the event as well as get some advice on how you might be able to control or identify invasives in your yard, on your property, on open space in your community or at your school. You can go to cipwg.ucon.edu. Donna, good luck with the event. Thank you so much once again for all this great information, and we'll see you up at UConn in October. Good luck. Well, anyone who is experiencing this week's heat is probably longing to head to the water where it's a little bit cooler. They could take a nice cool dip in the ocean into Long Island Sound. It's interesting that we're at this place at this time and meeting a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People. We had a couple of great conversations already offline with Dr. Peter Oster. He's a senior research scientist for the Mystic Aquarium, and he's also a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. And coincidentally, June is National Ocean Month, so it's a good time to talk about our connections to and our concerns about, and Peter's connections and his scientific community's concerns about Long Island Sound and the global ocean network it connects to. So, Peter, thanks for joining us. Here we are, National Ocean Month. Now, I guess my first question would be, is this a companion to a global ocean month, or is National Ocean Month something that is celebrated globally in each nation?
Well, so yeah, indeed, this is a global national month of the ocean, and June 8th was a global World Ocean Day. The president declared June to be National Ocean Month here in the United States, so there's been lots of activities and outreach to people all across the nation on their connections to the ocean.
And if I understand correctly, from a scientific standpoint, there is a rapidly growing concern, as there has been for some time, because we talk about Long Island Sound and its global connections and how it's really kind of a unique little engine and a critical component to the well-being of the global ocean network. Talking about climate change and some of the issues that climate change is bringing to not only Long Island Sound, but the way it influences and sort of impacts the rest of the world.
Yeah, indeed. You know, climate change isn't just an issue for tropical shallow coral reefs or for polar ecosystems. It's happening here in Long Island Sound as well, and our adjacent continental shelf. The composition of fishes that are in Long Island Sound is changing. We're shifting from species that are generally centered in colder climates farther to our north, and those moving up the coast from the south. We've traditionally harvested natural resources from the sea, and our economy has been, economies, especially early in human settlement here, has been built around those. You know, the challenge now is how do we manage use of these organisms sustainably, accounting the challenge now is how do we use these sustainably, accounting for the normal effects of nature, the effects of fishing, changes in land use, and now we need to pile on rapid climate change and how that affects what we thought previously was normal.
Mm-hmm.
We generally, are focused on a small number of species for food and recreation, animals like bluefish and winter flounder, beasts like that. And now changes to these populations are noticeable. But there are over 1,400 species that live in Long Island Sound and over 3,300 species that live off the adjacent continental shelf. And we have stewardship responsibilities for the rest of this biodiversity as well. So while managing for sustainable fisheries is an important issue, we just can't hope that everything else falls into place under this management regime alone.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in how much influence that scientists have when decisions are made either locally, nationally, or even globally about how industries like fishing readjust to say, at one point there's 1,000 different fleets that are going out for cod, and then cod begins to get depleted. And I'm just saying this as a hypothetical example. A third of that fleet needs to readjust to flounder or bluefish or lobster or seaweed, kelp. does science and commerce work together at all, never mind as good as it should, in helping to expedite these shifts in the commercial end of things to be able to, you know, sort of turn the Titanic, if you will, excuse the pun, up there at Mystic?
Yes, certainly. So, yes, well, you know, there are scientists that are involved in the process of understanding how populations of animals like cod are changing and in developing alternatives for management. You know, but the science side essentially tells us what our alternatives are and what the potential outcomes are from those that we might choose. But then there, you know, there's social and economic factors that are added to the decision making, and ultimately the decisions are made by fisher. Well, it depends on what level we're at. At the state level, it's through Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Mm-hmm. At the regional level, it's through the New England Fishery Management Council or the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council. And on the high seas, there are various treaty organizations that manage fishery resources. But there's always this tension between the economics of what we need to do tomorrow to keep industries viable, not just the boats, but the processing plants on shore and the distributors and the businesses that are on the receiving end of those products, and what might be the most expeditious choice that we need for rapid recovery of populations. So it's a tough seat to sit in to make these kinds of decisions, it's been tough to do.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the improvising, if you will, to ensure supply for those whose livelihoods and families depend on the bounty of the ocean, we've also seen, obviously much more advanced maybe in Europe and the UK, but I'm hearing a lot more about these concentrated fish farms, really, sequestered areas of the ocean that are, essentially closed off so that contractors can utilize those areas to raise and develop specific types of fish for the food industry?
Sure. I mean, here in the United States, aquaculture is becoming a larger and larger part of the seafood that people see in the market. Mm-hmm. Indeed, here in Long Island Sound, the oyster culture industry is huge, and the products from Long Island Sound go all over the world. That's essentially mariculture by manipulating the environment and moving the shellfish around, oysters, quahogs, scallops, species like that. Mm-hmm. And then, and where these industries take place, where these activities take place, is based on another set of management regimes. Mm-hmm. here in the Sound, and in a growing aquaculture industry offshore in federal waters. New here in Long Island Sound is the culture of kelp as a product that goes into both directly for consumers as well as into other food processes like carrageenan that goes into ice cream that makes it smooth and creamy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a growing part of industry. Really, globally, we've essentially topped out on the wild harvest, hunting of wild fish populations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certainly, especially in many nations, there's room for improvement. You used cod as an example earlier in our conversation. This is the species that essentially built our nation, and right now is at a historic low point. And in addition to warming temperatures, and despite draconian catch restrictions, whether these populations will recover or not remains to be seen. We're essentially trying to produce forecasts, 1, 2, 3 years down the road in a system that's very complicated, not just by by trying to forecast environmental conditions, but how different species interact in terms of predator-prey relationships, competitive interactions, those kinds of things. So it's a very complex and difficult. Well, it's a very complex endeavor with high degrees of uncertainty.
Mm. Well, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, but you know, we also have, you know, in order to understand what the ocean might look like in the absence of various types of human activities, you know, off our coast, about 180 miles from here, we have the only marine national monument in U.S. waters, the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, which is along the southern edge of Georgia's Bank, where submarine canyons cut into the edge of our continental shelf, and four seamounts, essentially extinct underwater volcanoes that are within our 200-mile zone that in 2016 were declared a marine national monument, and all commercial activities were excluded in the proclamation that designated that area, although red crab, trap fishing for red crabs and for lobsters were given a 7-year grace period to leave that area. So here's this place that we can be able to compare and contrast areas that are being used for various activities with one that is not, and then but all of these areas are subject to the larger global climate change processes. So we can be able to tease out, you know, what's us and our human activities versus what's at least larger scale variations due to nature and warming waters. Great. And it's a real biodiversity hotspot as well, so we get a lot of bang for the buck in having a very high number of species across multiple life zones, because, you know, like going up mountains and you go through different life zones, you know, when you drop down through the ocean from relatively shallow continental shelf into the deep ocean, down the sides of the canyons and up the sides of the seamounts, we see many different communities of animals that that live in different oceanographic conditions. Great. We also have National Marine Sanctuaries off our coast.
Peter, I apologize. We're about 2 minutes past the break. I just need to put a pause on that for just a moment.
Sure.
While we take a quick break, folks, we're talking with Dr. Peter Oster. He's a senior research scientist at the Mystic Aquarium, as well as a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. We are going to come back as he was poised to talk about, we're going to talk about National Marine Sanctuaries off the East Coast, as well as what folks can do, whether they're going to the shoreline this summer, they're somewhere inland, maybe practicing an activity that might be detrimental to Long Island Sound, even though it's 50, 60, 100 miles away. And we're going to lead off our discussion after the break on an important thing that you can do, and that is restrict your use of plastic. So we'll be back with Dr. Peter Oster in just a moment. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People here on this Labor Day weekend right after this news. How'd you like to get a little exercise while helping somebody out in the greater Naugatuck Valley? Here's your chance. Volunteer to help people in your local community who experience food insecurity on a regular basis. The Valley United Way Grow Your Own Neighborhood Community Garden program gives people in need a chance to maintain and harvest produce from their own neighborhood gardens at no cost, while also becoming educated about healthier ways to eat and live. To find out more about volunteering, visit valleyunitedway.org today. All right. Thanks for hanging around. Peter Oster is with us. He is a senior research scientist at Mystic Aquarium and a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. We're talking about Long Island Sound and its connection and important role it plays to our global ocean network here during June, at the tail end of June, actually, National Ocean Month. So, Peter, you were about to talk about the National Marine Sanctuaries, which reside just off the East Coast here. Tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. So these are sustainable, multiple-use areas. They're not closed to all commercial activities like the Marine National Monument. And these are great places to address questions about human use and balancing human patterns of human use and biodiversity conservation. There's a National Marine Sanctuary at Stellwagen Bank off the coast of Massachusetts. There's one farther down our coast off of Savannah, Georgia, Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary, and down off of Florida, Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. So we move from northern latitude to southern latitude, or cold temperate to subtropical and tropical ecosystems, where we can learn a lot about how we balance sustainable human uses and conservation of biodiversity to deal with all these different stewardship responsibilities we have.
So between the Marine National Monument that we talked about just before the break and these National Marine Sanctuaries, these must play critical roles and must be a welcome additions to the kind of global marine venue, if you will, for scientists like yourself and scientists all over the world. It's interesting how I'm sure you as a scientist may be looking at things that are going on in Russia and in Japan and down around Australia, and scientists there are looking at Long Island Sound. It's all part of this National Ocean Month initiative and the kind of work that you do 365 days a year.
Well, so exactly. So the challenge here is looking at ecosystems and communities within them that either behave similarly to different types of human disturbances and natural disturbances, and how some respond differently to those disturbances. So ultimately, the science of ecology will provide guidance for how we might sustainably use these natural resources that we all depend on.
Great. Well, let's give the folks listening some guidance on how virtually everyone can play a role and make a positive difference in not only the health of Long Island Sound, but the entire global ocean network. And in the last 4 minutes or so that we have with you, let's dig into the subject of plastics.
Sure. Well, so hopefully, you know, as people go to the shoreline this summer, I hope they spend a few minutes thinking about our role, our human role as stewards of these places, and that while the ocean looks the same from the surface, whether it's healthy or impacted, we all have a role in ensuring this vibrant future for the oceans and the creatures that live within it. For National Oceans Month is really focused on plastic pollution. 80% of all pollution in the oceans comes from people on land. There's 8 million tons of plastic per year that ends up in the ocean. And I don't mean just the people living, you know, along Long Island Sound, globally.
These are just the bottles tossed in at the beach.
Exactly. And, you know, it wreaks havoc on wildlife and fisheries and tourism. Plastic costs the lives of 1 million seabirds and 100,000 marine mammals each year, based on some United Nations estimates. You know, fish eat plastic and we eat fish. So the contaminants that stick to the plastics and leach out of the plastics ultimately, you know, ends up in us. You know, whether there's deleterious effects or not, in most cases, remain to be seen. But you know, we're tossing this into these things into the food chain. It costs society money, $8 billion in damage to marine ecosystems each year from plastic pollution.
To say nothing of the real cost to recreational and commercial boaters, from these massive aircraft carriers and ocean liners all the way down to the single engine, like little recreational putt-arounds that are going around alongshore here in Long Island Sound. When they get wrapped up in this plastics, it can have as much of effect on a boat propeller and drive shaft that's 3 stories high as it can on one that's about 6 inches tall, right?
Absolutely. Well, in this plastic ends up getting sucked into the cooling systems for these engines, or blocking the filters for these engines. So there's all kinds of real potential problem.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to save a minute for you because just a couple of days ago, as we're taping this and airing it on Sunday, you've got a brand new exhibit up at the Mystic Aquarium that you played
a
role in. Tell us about that.
Mystic Aquarium just opened a new exhibit focused on Long Island Sound, with a water table touch tank that represents the watershed that drains into the sound and animals that live within it. that children can touch and learn about, so you know they're not scared of things that live in the ocean, but are fascinated and wonder about their lives. There are interactive exhibits for both adults and children. They can learn about species that live in the different habitats that are part of the Long Island Sound ecosystem, from the rivers and the coast to the deep water, and information on restoration and stewardship projects that are happening now and ways that they might get involved.
And I guess so, the best way for folks to not only get involved, but to stay involved and get even a heightened level of involvement is to not only come out and see the exhibit at Mystic Aquarium, but become a member of the Mystic Aquarium family, because then you get all kinds of previews and special deals and early access and additional information, emails and newsletters and things. So that's always great. Or if their kids are getting older, hey, consider joining Peter at the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. They'd be happy to have you if that is something that your young high schooler or even elementary schooler is interested in, possibly as a career.
We're always looking for sharp and motivated students.
Excellent. So it's National Ocean Month here in June, and our brand new go-to authority on it is Dr. Peter Oster, representing the Mystic Aquarium as a senior research scientist as well as a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. Peter, thank you so much. Great to meet you, and can't wait to talk again. Well, we have been very pleased to welcome representatives from the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, or CERC, over the past few quarters as they have been presenting these studies that they're doing called Inform CT, Connecticut Consumer Confidence Surveys. And we are into and past quarter two for 2018. And we're pleased to bring CERC CEO Bob Santee onto the program this morning to talk about some of the results from the latest survey. These are important gauges of how Connecticut residents are feeling about the state's economy. And Bob, it seems like you guys are kind of setting the standard when it comes to kind of keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on in Connecticut. And as the economy has been slowly upticking across the country, doggedly dragging Connecticut behind it, it seems like the mood in this second quarter survey is even a little bit more upbeat than a few months ago.
Yes, it sure is. Yeah.
So quickly, for folks that may not be familiar with Inform CT, give them the quick elevator spiel on what they need to know.
Yeah, we call it the Research and Policy Institute for Connecticut, and it's really a virtual organization at this point that is a collaborative effort between our research staff here at CERC and the Connecticut Data Collaborative. And really what we're out there doing is trying to make sure that policymakers have more data and good research to support better public policy decisions.
Okay. So we kind of talked before we turned on the mic. This has been going on for several years now.
Yeah, it's about, I think, our 15th quarter. So we're starting to get some linear data so that we can look back and say, gee, are things getting better? Are we moving in the right direction? And certainly this quarter's poll shows that people are pretty upbeat about what's happening in Connecticut. So it also shows that we still have a distance to go.
Yeah. Well, with all this now deepening historic data, does it come to a point where you sort of change direction and put out a different kind of study that's a digest and compilation of all of the data to sort of create a benchmark, if you will?
Yeah, I think we do two things. One is, do you want to keep asking the same questions so you continue to have a point of reference over time? But you also can add questions. And we invite listeners, by the way, if they're interested in suggesting questions to us, we'd be happy to hear from them. So every quarter we ask a couple of different questions. We asked this quarter a little bit about what are the most important issues that you are thinking about as you go to vote for governor or for legislature or for Congress, and that was interesting as well.
Yeah, and here we are as we tape this on primary day here in Connecticut. Were these questions gauged toward a primary general election or just across the board general political wherewithal?
Well, it was generally across the board, but we asked them to differentiate between, whether they were voting for governor, state legislature, or U.S. Congress, and whether there was a difference in the importance level. And at the very least, it showed that people understand that the U.S. Congress has more to do with foreign affairs than your governor does. But it was also very clear that people have pocketbook issues on their minds. What's happening with our taxes? What's happening in the economy? Is there enough job growth in Connecticut? Those were the issues that came out on top.
So this was the highest amount of folks surveyed saying their impression was Connecticut's conditions are better or have increased since the January through March of 2016.
Right.
To you, as the leader of CERC, how is that substantially significant?
Yeah. Well, let me differentiate two things. One is that, almost 80% said that they expect that business conditions are better and they expect them to continue to be better. And 31% said that Connecticut's economy is improving, and that actually was up 7 points from last year. So that's moving in the right direction. But there's a big difference between the 80% that said business conditions are good and those that see Connecticut's economy improving. And I will tell you that what I see there is that the business conditions probably reflect national trends to a greater degree. That, stock markets are up. We had a quarter that just finished where we had 4.1% growth nationally. People like the idea that the biggest tax act, at least if the president is correct, the biggest tax cut in history was passed. Whereas if you talk about Connecticut's economy, it's great that more people think we're moving forward, but they're still concerned about jobs. They're still concerned about the fiscal situation in Connecticut and whether we have it solved. So those are the two things I take from those two questions.
Okay. Also, business conditions overall, that also received a high degree of confidence from the folks surveyed.
Yes, it did. And I think that's really what reflects national trends to a large degree.
And is that what you're actually seeing in terms of the flip side? Are businesses also kind of in concurrence that things are going better?
Yes, it'll be interesting. CBIA will be coming out with their business survey shortly, and we'll be able to compare the two. I would say anecdotally that we do hear from businesses that they are investing. There's a great confidence that manufacturing is growing in Connecticut, and that's driven in large degree by a defense budget that will benefit Electric Boat and United Technologies and Sikorsky. In all three of those instances, there's going to be increased defense manufacturing. But that's the first time in decades, that we've seen this type of growth in manufacturing. Now we have the challenge of finding the qualified people to fill all those jobs.
Right, which is a point of another question on the survey.
Yeah. Yes, I think, people are confident that they're doing well, that their employment is pretty safe You know, there's always some people that say, yeah, I'm concerned that my husband or my wife might not maintain their position. But people are feeling pretty good about their own economic situation, and that's great. But we do have this skills gap. We do need to do something about training people to fill some of these manufacturing jobs. And the great thing about that is, you know, 25 years ago, we replaced manufacturing jobs with service sector jobs that didn't pay as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the opportunity to see that trend reversed as the manufacturing employment goes up.
And I see still about a little over half the folks that were surveyed don't think there are enough jobs.
Yes, but I think the story there was that a lot more people think there are plenty of jobs if anyone wants them. That went up as well. But, you know, there's a lag, I think. It'll be interesting to see that question in a couple of quarters where it's very clear that the manufacturing, the companies that we were talking about, are adding jobs. And I'll bet you we'll see that tick up again.
Yeah, and we're also not just with CERC and Inform CT, but with a few other studies that were projecting, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of half of the people surveyed would be considering possibly leaving Connecticut in the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm.
Your survey asked about whether or not Connecticut was a good place to live and raise a family. What was the result of that question on the
Inform
CT survey?
More people think it is, which is great to hear. That's heading in the right direction as well. That people do believe it's a great place to live. 55% said that they thought it was a great place to live and raise a family, and that's up from 49% in the past study. You know, the question about people who are thinking of leaving the state, we've done a lot of discussion about that here. But, you know, the interesting thing is we don't know that other states ask that question. And we started asking that question when it was a really hot issue in Connecticut. And so we don't know whether – so right now we have 40% saying they might leave, 42% saying they probably would stay, and 18% that are undecided. But that 42% is the first time that it's been a larger number than those that are considering leaving. And you also have to look at why people might leave. And this is what we don't know. We have a lot of – baby boomers that might be considering retiring and moving out of state. We have a lot of young people, because we're a small state geographically, who may decide to go to a college outside of state. So they would be leaving the state, maybe to return. We don't know.
Mm.
So and actually, the states that most of people leave for in from Connecticut are New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, then followed by Florida. So in most instances, it's probably an employment situation. But
yeah,
that's a really interesting question that we need to delve into some more.
Yeah, and the other thing that was interesting about this is we talk about confidence in either holding or being able to secure a job,
yep,
the feeling that business is doing better, feeling that Connecticut's economy is doing better. That is resulting in people kind of opening up their wallets,
yes,
in regards to vacations, refinancing their homes. There's a lot of information that was provided in this quarter survey to consumers about how they're going to be spending some of the money they're either perceiving,
right,
they're going to earn or are actually earning now.
Well, if I'm any example, I'm the poster child for spending more money in the last two quarters, I will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Between a vacation celebrating our 40th anniversary
and
visiting a new grandchild, and, you know, that's putting a new kitchen in. So I'm just trying to make sure that that coincides with what the Inform CT is saying.
So,
no, it's great. It's people are buying cars, they're buying durable goods, they are taking vacations out of state, and that doesn't bother me. I mean, there's plenty to do in Connecticut, of course, but we are the third smallest state, so it's not surprising that people might go elsewhere.
Very good. And let's just take the rest of the time that we have with you, Bob Santee, and just kind of wind up on a couple of the other points. 32% in regards to personal finances say they're better off now than 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. That's still a pretty low percentage, even though it appears people are willing to spend the money that they have for vacations and appliances and cars and things.
Yeah. Yeah. As I've said, I think we're moving in the right direction. You pointed out that Connecticut historically lags other areas of the country in recovering from recessions, and this has been no different than those. It's actually taken us longer than in most instances. So moving in the right direction, but still got a ways to go. And, you know, that's why there's some hesitancy. And I would say even if they feel that the economy's looking good from their own paycheck and that's helpful, there's still this underlying sense that the state's fiscal health has not been fully addressed. And, of course, it's interesting also that when you ask the questions, what's happening in the world around us is an important consideration. So here we have all of this advertising about the primary today, and a lot of it isn't saying very nice things about Connecticut. So that does impact people's feelings about their own situation.
Yeah, well, what I think is really going to be interesting is after you and I celebrate the holidays and we get together in mid-January, mm-hmm. to look back at the survey that incorporated some questioning post-election as we bring in all this new leadership in, yes. Hartford and the 5th District and a few other important political leadership positions in the state, and to see how that actual reality has set in to, yep. To folks here in Connecticut. But in the meantime, we've got another quarter to go before that, so I'm sure, yep. we'll be speaking with you or a representative of the Connecticut Economic Resource Center. Folks, thanks for tuning in. Bob Santee's with us. He is CEO of CIRC, talking about quarter two 2018 of the results of Inform CT, which is a public-private partnership providing independent and nonpartisan research, analysis, and public outreach with the Connecticut Economic Resource Center. So, Bob, thank you so much for your time this morning and this information, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of months.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.